Good morning. Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Church of Belfast. My name is Andrea Butler, and I'm a member of the Worship Arts team. Welcome on this beautiful fall-ish day, first day of October. Come in from the crisp morning air outside. Come in wearing the autumn sunlight on your face. Come carrying the turning of seasons in your heart. Whatever and however the greatness of life is speaking to you now, you are welcome here in our circle of friends. Here today, in this place, and with these people, may we listen so that we can hear, may we hear so that we can feel, may we feel so that we can know, and may we know so that we can change ourselves in this world. May this chalice we light our way.
Good morning. A couple of weeks ago, Reverend Janu, the Methodist minister here in Belfast, asked me when we were going to have our open house because his congregation wanted to come over and check it out. I would say, not that we checked everybody, but I would say the majority of people who came to the open house yesterday were from the Methodist Church. There was one couple, for example, who did say they were Methodists, and they were just staring at the ceiling and at the stained glass, and we were talking about how interesting it was that the stained glass didn't have any religious symbols on it, given that it was, again, a Methodist church at one time. And apparently, two people from the Methodist church met here. They didn't know they were each coming, and just gave each other a big warm hug and moved through the building together in a very touching way because this had been their church at one time. Not everybody, of course, was from the Methodist Church. We had members, friends of members, neighbors, and a number of other people who just really enjoyed it. And it made me wonder what, on one hand, it meant to have an open house, but what did it mean to be an open house? What would it mean for us to understand our building, our space, our community as itself an open house? So I will leave you with that. What does it mean to be an open house? Blessed be.
Oh,
As the season shifts from summer to autumn, there seems to be an anxiety-driven response to living life. Responsibilities once again become real, and we tend to sacrifice ourselves in order to achieve our goals. Nature is changing all around us, and there is very little energetic stability, and so it is only natural for us to feel overwhelmed with all that must be done. Rather than harness that energy, we begin to doubt our capabilities, judge ourselves, and compare ourselves to others. Rather than pulling away from these feelings, it is critical for us to lean into them so they no longer limit us from what we truly are capable of. You have the power and ability to achieve everything you want in this life, and as nature teaches us during these transitional seasons, change occurs gradually, choice by choice. Nature takes her time to transition, the leaves change color over many days, and it takes months before branches are bare. I'd like us to take a few minutes here to center ourselves. Please close your eyes. Take a few deep breaths. Let us be more accepting and open to the change that is occurring all around us.
A samurai who is known for his nobility and honesty went to visit a Zen monk to ask advice. However, the moment he entered the temple where the master was praying, he felt inferior and concluded that in spite of having fought for justice and peace all his life, he hadn't even come near the state of grace achieved by the man before him. "Why do I feel so inferior?" he asked as soon as the monk finished his prayers. "I have faced death many times, have defended those who are weak. I know I have nothing to be ashamed of. Nonetheless, upon seeing you meditating, I felt that my life had absolutely no importance whatsoever." "Wait," responded the monk. "Once I have attended to all those who have come to see me today, I shall answer you." The samurai spent the whole day sitting in the temple gardens, watching the people go in and out in search of advice. He saw how the monk received them all with the same patience and the same illuminated smile on his face. But his enthusiasm soon began to wane, since he had been born to act and not to wait. At nightfall, when everyone had gone, he demanded, "Now can you teach me?" The master invited him in and led him to his room. The full moon shone in the sky, and the atmosphere was one of profound tranquility. "Do you see the moon? How beautiful it is. It will cross the entire nighttime sky, and tomorrow the sun will shine once again. But sunlight is much brighter and can show the details of the landscape around us, trees, mountains, clouds. I have contemplated the two for years and have never heard the moon say, 'Why do I not shine like the sun?' Is it because I am inferior?" "Of course not," answered the samurai. "The moon and the sun are different things. Each has its own beauty. You cannot compare the two." "So you know the answer. We are two different peoples, each struggling in his own way for that which he believes and making it possible to make the world a better place. The rest are mere appearances." Who are we? How do we manifest in the world that which is deepest inside us? What is true and what is appearance? Why is it that we compare, judge, and criticize people, including ourselves? How do we forgive ourselves and the world? How do we see beauty within and without when there is so much pain in the world? Unitarian Universalist minister Robert Fulghum has similar questions when he talks about one of his favorite visual artists, Brancusi, who has been called the patriarch of modern sculpture. By the time Brancusi died in 1957, writes Fulghum, he had made many versions of a few ideas. One major work, Bird in Space, was carried to completion at least 28 times in wood, marble, plaster, and bronze. Each version was slightly different, and each time he was trying to express his feeling of flying. He wanted to catch an idea of the air, of soaring itself. It's true that he was hammered by the critics in his own day for not turning out a wider variety of subject matter, for working away at the same themes over and over instead of moving on to new things. But Brancusi explained that innovation was not his way. Only a few very basic subjects engaged him, very common aspects of existence. A kiss, the prodigal son, the beginning of life, human beauty. And he wanted to keep trying to cut away everything extraneous to his feelings about these subjects and express them as simply as possible in sculpture. You will notice, admits Full Jim in relation to his own writings, that I have come back again and again to a few themes that hold me close. Questions, actually, that I keep on the front burner of my mental stove, such as, how shall I achieve a living balance between the mundane and the holy? Between humor and grief? Between what is and what might be? Between self-concern and concern for the common good? Between the worst that I often am and the best I might well become? And is it really possible to do unto others as I'd have them do unto me? And why is it so hard? I imagine that we all have some similar fundamental questions that we ask ourselves about life, questions that we keep on the front burner of our mental stove. In our elder, albeit wise, covenant group we call Seasoned Souls, we always light a chalice and check in with the words, "How is your spirit?" This week's discussion centered on the concept of spirit itself. What does spirit really mean? We were informed that the ancient Greek philosopher Plotinus urged people to cut away all that is excessive, straighten all that is crooked, bring light to all that is overcast, and labor to make all one radiance of beauty. Some of the questions we were asked to ponder were, how has your spirit, soul, self changed over time? How is your spirit, soul, self the same? What difference, what influenced the changes you have observed in your spirit? Were these influences chosen or random occurrences? These are good questions. And they suggest that something within us changes over time. I think this is true if we talk about ourselves with a small s, a small s. I've mentioned before, Hinduism talks about another self with a capital S, which it calls Atman, Atman. It is the essence of our very being, and it is one with the essence of the universe, which Hinduism calls Brahman, Brahman. What would it mean if our true self, capital S, does not in fact change? What if at the core of our very being, after we peel away all of the layers, we find our essence? What if this is what we mean by our journey in life, that what we are really searching for is the being of our true self, capital S? And what if this is actually the Holy Grail, and all of us are knights looking to find the holy? I do not know if any of this is true, nor do I think I will ever know for certain, because it is unabashedly a faith statement. There is no way to prove anything that transcends words or reason. But I do not fear the use of the word faith or of making faith statements, as long as they never, never can be used to create some form of violence. Religion itself is not the problem, but rather the faith and belief systems that invariably lead to violence. So I firmly believe with Hinduism that there is a core self that is united with the core self of the universe, that Atman and Brahman are one. Let me put it another way. What if our soul is compassion itself? That compassion is our soul, our being, our very center. And I don't think it is any mere coincidence that compassion is also at the center of all the great religions of the world. Granted, sometimes we have lots of layers to remove before we see this about ourselves and about others. And it's hard to see when we look primarily at the dark side of people, of the shadow side that manifests itself through all forms of abuse, trauma, violence, and apathy. So let me put it one more way. What if we could see the unchangeable essence or being of ourselves as beauty with a capital B? What if our life's journey is to know ourselves and consequently others as beauty itself? One of my favorite novels is C.S. Lewis's book, Till We Have Faces. It is the retelling of the Cupid and Psyche myth, a myth that apparently haunted Lewis for much of his life. This is actually the last novel that he wrote, and Lewis himself thought of it as his best and most mature work. His friend J.R.R. Tolkien agreed. Lewis's story is told from the perspective of Psyche's older sister, Orwell. After her father dies, Orwell becomes queen of the fictitious land of Gloam. She herself seems to have some kind of deformity, making her appear ugly, and so she always wears a veil. Her sister Psyche, on the other hand, is so beautiful that the people of the kingdom present her with gifts and sacrifices as though she were a goddess. Primarily and perhaps unwittingly, Orwell's jealousy and pride lead to Psyche leaving the kingdom, and Orwell lives most of her life alone and loveless. And then she rails against the gods and justice, and she becomes bitter and psychologically more ugly. When she is considerably older, Orwell has a series of dreams and visions. In them, she is required to perform several impossible tasks, like having to fetch a bowl of water from a spring on a mountain that cannot be climbed and is inhabited by poisonous creatures. Orwell begins to realize the truth about herself and what it is she has done out of her own jealousy and hubris. Perhaps it is another vision, perhaps not. When she is led to see that Psyche has accomplished all of the impossible tasks of her visions in her stead. And then she meets Psyche once again, after Psyche completes the last task. And the last task is retrieving a box of beauty from the underworld. It is then that the god of the mountains, or Cupid in the original myth, comes to be with Psyche and to judge Orwell. But there is no judgment. The vision ends with the god's words to Orwell, "You too shall be Psyche." Psyche is beauty personified. Psyche is the god's partner. Psyche is Orwell's heart. They are all one and the same. Similar to Orwell, we are all engaged in the hero's journey. We all have many tasks and struggles in life as we work to transform our ego, or little self, to our true self. And then we become aware that we are Psyche. We too are beauty itself. Since myths tell us something about the truth of our own humanness, I imagine Orwell's Psyche and Cupid, the god of love, as being one and the same, declaring simply and profoundly, I, beauty. May it be so, and amen. These are not typical closing words. In fact, I would like to suggest some homework. I would like to suggest that at least 6 times every day this week, we say to ourselves, I, beauty, and try to mean it. I suggest this as a daily spiritual practice. It is a mantra, if you wish, one that I hope gives you a sense of who you are, who your neighbor is, who the stranger is. I, beauty. May it be so.